You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm really delighted to be introducing Lena this evening. Lena will be speaking on her book, How Half Arse Human. Here's a copy. And it's really exciting. It's good. She is a poet, producer, presenter, podcaster, vlogger. She's multi-award winning, and her YouTube channel has amassed over 25 million views, which is amazing. So cool. We are going to be having a Q&A this evening. So if you've not been to Greenbelt before, or maybe perhaps you've been too nervous to ask a question, now is your chance. Think of those questions. And when it comes to it, we'll be looking out for you. So yeah, please do raise your hands when it comes to it. Lena will also be doing a book signing at 8 o'clock in G Books, just over there for half an hour. So you can pick up a copy and have it signed. So without further ado, please give a big Greenbelt welcome to Lena Norms.
Stop it. It's almost a bit flirty. We haven't met yet. Steady on. Thank you so much for having me. It's really lovely to be talking to you all. I feel very at home at Greenbelt. I've been coming for about 15 years, and this really is a home from home. It's kind of insulting that we're not here all year round. I can't believe we have to go out there again. Gross. Don't want to go. And I can really recommend becoming an angel purely for bragging rights and being able to be like, looks like your phone's on low battery. I can charge that for you, you know. I'm an angel, because you get free charging if you're an angel. I'm just saying, it's actually worth the mental health investment. Seriously, I'm all about bragging rights. So hi, my name's Lena, and I am a half-arser. That feels really scary to say, or it would have done if I hadn't not published a book on it. And now I've been talking about it a lot. The exposure therapy has been really good for me. So before, I probably would have never said that I was a half-arser. If you are a half-arser, you might be considered somebody who is insincere, flaky, disingenuous, sloppy, lazy. And I didn't want to be any of those things. I wanted to be, for want of a better word, a whole arser. somebody who throws themselves at life. And I'd look at these people who seem to be completely sitting on the seat of life, both arse cheeks down, really committed. And in the right seat as well. Like, they didn't question which seat they were in. They were like, this is my seat and I will be here. And I'd feel really jealous of them. And I'd be like, God, how do they know what seat to sit in? How are they sitting in it so well? How are they so present? And how are they doing everything on their to-do lists, like, incredibly? And then I'd look around and I'd be like, well, not everybody is sitting on their seat the whole way, are they? Some people are only half committing. Like, they've got half their cheek down. They're kind of ready to run away. They are, like, in the seat. They've picked a seat, but they often, like, don't turn up for things, or, you know, they say they're going to do something and they won't. Or, like, I thought that they said they were going to be vegan this week, but I actually saw them sit, like, eating a massive Nutella crepe at that stand over there. I've seen it. And there was also those people who were kind of on the edge of their seat. Like, they weren't, it wasn't that they were uncommitted, but they were so enraptured with everything else around them and, like, almost over distracted, like, I want to be a bit like that. No, I want to do that. They were also not on their seat. They were really interesting to talk to, and they knew a lot, but they hadn't really, you could see there was something in their eyes. They were like, I just can't, you know, I can't actually be present in my own life, because I can't work out what to actually commit to. And I realized, as I was becoming more and more jealous of all these people who were, like, you know, doing different things with their asses in their seats, that I had become something much worse. I had become a hovering ass. I was above the seat all the time, trying to pick out, like, the best way to do it, which angle is best, which seat. And I have a little diagram in this book that is just has a picture of a bum on it, and it's above a seat, and then it just says, this is where hope goes to die, in the space between the ass and the seat. So I wrote a whole book talking about all the things that we feel pressure to put everything into, and how we often think about every section of our lives and we're like, I could be doing that better. Like, here's how I would do that. I've seen somebody on Instagram, that's how they're whole-arsing that. I could be doing that. But we don't look at the whole picture and go, actually, is it possible to whole ass whole parts of our lives? And in trying to perfect everything, are we actually failing at the things that really matter to us? And if we're not confident in which seat we're supposed to be sitting in, have we told all the other to-do lists to go away so we can actually work out which seat to sit at? And I find a little bit of hope in this. And there's actually a little bit of kind of cultural architecture that I've always been interested in. So I thought I'd read a tiny little section from the chapter on half-assed hope to talk a little bit more about that. It's called A Very Boring Revolution. My local supermarket was built on the presumption that most people would visit by car. I am willing to bet that yours probably was too. It means that the people who built it made a groovy little plan for exactly where they would like you to enter the car park and where to exit once you're done. Of course, they also built a path for pedestrians, just one, which is an entrance and an exit on one side of the building. Slight problem. The pedestrians who live near me can't be tamed. When the hangry hits, we ignore the commands of the concrete and stomp forward in all directions. Since they built the supermarket in the middle of a housing estate with possible shoppers on all sides, they probably should have guessed that there's no way we can be persuaded to walk three sides of a rectangle just to use the proper path. But perhaps the town planners never have craved hobnobs in the visceral way that I have. A thousand of lawless, rerouted troops my fellow citizens and I have made to this supermarket have left a mark. Clear makeshift paths have formed in the grass where we've all cut corners in pursuit of stock cubes, gin, cigarettes and curly whirlies. Grass has ceased to grow there, the soil has sunk in. It has become, to all intents and purposes, a path. No one built it. No one planned it. No one can claim to have started it. And yet, there it is, existing, usable, a part of the landscape. These conspiratorial trails have appeared around every supermarket I have ever lived near. But it wasn't until recently I realised there is actually a name for them. There's actually several names because it's such a common thing throughout loads of different cultures and countries. It's called a desire line, a fisherman's track, a buffalo trace, a bootleg trail, a social route and a use path. But whatever they are, I kind of adore them. They're like a collective conspiracy against town planners. You thought you had a pan? I don't think so. I need my curly whirlies. A visual guide in the soil that shows the exact distance between what we expect people to do and what, in reality, we actually do. If you Google desire paths or similar, you can see thousands of pictures from all over the world of community-carved paths veering dramatically away from the pavements and paths laid out for them. Perhaps I'm just strapped for places to find hope, but this silent, undiscussed rebellion gives me a little smirk every time I see one. The desire paths are cooked up by groups of people who are united only by location and defiance, who have probably never spoken and perhaps wouldn't like each other if they did. Who don't arrange to meet or agree on a plan, but slowly chip away at the default settings of life until they've carved out their own route. And what is cooler than that? I've also realised that these trails are a great example of how I see half-arsing. To a town planner or the building firm who spent hours laying and levelling the concrete routes, these makeshift paths might seem like a visual symbol of laziness. They might roll their eyes at anyone who might, they might roll their eyes as anyone might when they spend a lot of money and time on a plan and the people it is intended for refuse to join in. But if we look at these routes as Wikipedia does, as desire lines, we can see that they're actually secret stompings of real intention. They say, this is my place, my soil too. This is how I want to travel from A to B. My time is precious and your route doesn't hold any advantage for me. I am prepared to get my boots muddy for a faster route to the crumpets. They're not only a personal twos up to what is expected, but a collective evidence that low effort, small rebellions can be scuffed out of stubborn soil. And so I wrote a lot about this idea. And one of the topics I came across was veganism. such an embarrassing topic to talk about. And so intricate in all the different moral compasses it can bring up for people. It stresses me out talking about it. I'm sweating a little bit now, I'm not going to lie. But it's something that unfortunately I've started reading about, which I don't recommend you do, because it's actually very, very evidence-based. And there's lots of really good arguments about it. And it's really hard to deny that it's probably the direction we should be going in. However, I love curly whirlies, and that is one of the great tensions in my life. So I started coming up. I used to eat meat, and I don't anymore. But when I was a meat eater and very proud of it, I had a friend that was vegan, and every now and then she'd have, like, I don't know if you've ever been a meat eater in a friendship group of vegetarians and vegans, but there's like a secret conspiracy, the way they come to confess their longings to you. It's like their dirty little secrets. So I had a friend who'd be like, Lena, every now and then I just want a sausage, like a big Cumberland juicy sausage with little apple bits in it. And she'd have a little crazed look in her eyes. And I was like, look, mate, right, here's the thing. If you're doing this for the planet and we're looking at impact, if you really, really want a sausage and you feel like if you don't have a sausage, your whole soul will break and maybe you'll just stop being vegan altogether or something will happen, text me and I won't eat a sausage that day. In fact, I'll go vegan for the whole day and like nothing will have happened in the eyes of the ecosystem. Do you see what I mean? Like, we can cancel this out. And I started, that's girl maths. It worked. And I think it's this mental thing of like, right, if we can't handle committing to something full time, or the idea of like tying our relationships and our identity to something, but we think it might be a good idea and we'd like to try it, but in a way that we might want to backpedal later, we don't want to be held to. I wonder if there's ways that we can think about changing some parts of the world in a more collective way that leaves room for error or exceptions, or like, my mum will force me to have Christmas dinner, you don't understand. she's a force of nature. And I'm working out different ways to do that. So I came up with all these different ways. So there's like the idea of being a Brexit vegan. What would that be? I don't know. We'll brainstorm that later. A breakfast vegan, because breakfast is the easiest meal to switch out. There's a great book called We Are the Weather about it by Jonathan Safran Foer. And like stuff like peanut butter and jam on toast is a vegan breakfast. And if we all had that, we'd all be having a great time, but we'd also be eating a vegan breakfast. And loads of different things we can do around that. I talked about being a brand vegan. So the rule is you eat how you always eat, but occasionally, say like if Richmond also makes vegan sausages, you buy those. Or Nutella makes vegan Nutella, you try that out just once. Tag vegan is what I talked about, where it's like, I did it with a friend. So you can do like, okay, I could only be vegan like half the week. Just organize it with a friend. Which days are you going to do? Do you need to switch? It's like being a divorced parent. You're like, let's just get a schedule going. And if you've got a holiday coming up, like, we'll make it work. eating out vegans. A lot of people struggle with cooking. I'm one of them. I'm just, every time I make something, it just looks like I already have eaten it and thrown it up. Like, I don't really understand. But being an eat out vegan is very easy, because it means that you're literally already employing somebody else to cook for you. So you might as well be like, can you make it vegan and nice? And see what happens. There's an eat-in vegan. So if you live somewhere where people like smirk at you and you ask if they've got oat milk, then you can maybe try and do it just in the house and like let yourself off that. There's condiment vegan, where you just switch out your condiments. A Nigella vegan, which is where you just try a new vegan recipe every month. So I go through loads of different options with that. And I talk about how when we think about committing to lifestyles or like who we're going to be, why we might not actually have to throw our whole selves in, or we can say to our communities, like, I would like this to be a thing, but I don't think that I can do the thing. Would you like to do some fractions and work out how many of these things to do? But it also made me think, writing this book made me think about all the things that we do that I'm not sure if we actually need to do. So I decided to go through some of the research and check. And it turns out some things don't even need to be half-assed. We can completely take them off the menu. For example, skincare, not a thing. retinol, it's not getting in. vitamin C, that would be really good for your skin if it could get into your skin, but you have an amazing skin barrier. So a lot of the things that we talk about, like vitamin C is really good for your skin, I'm like, yeah, if it could get in there, but it can't. It's got a lot of people at the door stopping it from getting in. Another one is 10,000 steps a day. Does anybody try and do that? How are we getting on? Not good. That's okay, because that's a made up number. In the 1960s, there was a Japanese pedometer company who wanted to come up with a number that people should be aiming for, and they thought 10,000 would just sound like a really cool number to aim for. There's no health research backing up that 10,000 number. Can you believe it? It's actually between 6,000 and 7,000. So if you're doing that, you're totally fine. And that's do. You can just go and get yeah, see? Totally fine. Another thing is exercise in general. So there's a great book on this. Shh, don't do it. You heard it here first. Exercise kills. Stay still. there's this amazing book called The First 20 Minutes, and it really released something within me. It talks about like almost all of the mortality reductions and health benefits associated with exercise can be attributed to the first 20 minutes, and after that's kind of diminishing returns. It's actually better that you do it more often and less than like pushing yourself to the limit and then getting a really bad memory of that exercise experience and not doing it again for a month. And it's called like curvilinear returns. So lots of stuff in the book about exercise and how we might not need to put as much pressure on ourselves as we do. Yeah, like the volume of training. So again, when we talk about the 1st of January is usually when we're advised to change our lives and change everything up. And then we're usually quitting it by February. It's actually not medically recommended to just start a really vigorous exercise routine. You're only supposed to be upping it by 10% a week maximum. So if you're doing nothing, just 10% more of what you might want to do in the future is much better. Has anybody ever killed a houseplant? You murderers. I've got so many evil people in the room. No, I have killed so many houseplants. I used to feel really, really bad about it. And mainly I just felt like it was a symbol of being an adult. Like I was like, if I can't keep a houseplant alive, what else am I going to kill? Like my sense of self? Any future children? Other people? Like why can't I keep a houseplant alive? And it turns out that I had all these embedded beliefs about how good houseplants were for you. Again, literally no research proves this. It doesn't clean our air. National Geographic did a whole big research like spread on it and was like, the only way that houseplant would make your air in your house any cleaner is if you only had plants and no furniture. Like that's the only way. There's also no evidence that having green plants in your house makes you calmer or happier. Anecdotally, it might. You might be the person it works for, but there's no research proving that you are happier if you have houseplants. There is, however, a huge, embarrassingly massive amount of research on how good it is to actually just be outside. Very cheap and simple, and you can't kill the outdoors, or at least not legally. And also like being in a room and being able to see the outside, that is an amazing amount for your mental health. So watching your neighbor's houseplants thrive, very, very good for you, would recommend. Yeah, I also had like a lot of different beliefs about being a half-assed human when it came to phrases that would come up. So has anybody heard of a jack of all trade is a master of none? So turns out that's only half the phrase. What? The whole phrase is a jack of all trades is a master of none, but always much better than a master of one. And it's this lesson from our, yay! It's a lesson from our ancestors that's just like, don't try and just be good at one thing. That's dangerous. What if you're the only person who can do that thing in your tribe? Like, don't do that. So that was a really interesting one. And then also there was one that I'm going to find my page for in a second. Give me 1 second. And yes, so this is another one. I'm going to read it from the book because I sound a bit more intelligent in the book. So I'd like to read it out. A final reminder that the perfect is pointless. I'd like to tell you about the history of the phrase, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. To the modern ear, it describes the act of going it alone, of achieving greatness without any external help. A person who pulls themselves up by their bootstraps has reason to be proud. They're succeeding without whinging, against the odds, no fannying about. Except that is not how it started. The story goes that it first appeared in print in an American newspaper in 1837 in a sarcastic account of somebody attempting something that was totally absurd. The phrase goes, probably Mr. Murphy has succeeded in handing himself over the Cumberland River or a barnyard fence by the straps of his boots. The phrase is then used throughout the 19th century as a way of laughing at those who attempt silly feats or to criticise governments for expecting the impossible from its citizens rather than helping them. Here's one from the Vermont Watchman and State Journal in 1836. It is of no less preposterous that a government whose constitution recognizes the rational freedom of its subjects should hope for the perpetuity with a due encouragement of practical education that one should attempt to lift himself up by pulling at his own bootstraps. So it's this idea that like that was not the plan at all. I wonder how much that shift in the way this phrase is used is part of a societal tendency to put all the responsibility for winning on the individual and all the blame on them when they lose. That we could be extraordinary is a compliment, but the expectation that we should be is a one-way ticket to hell. It's easy to absorb this mindset without rationalising it, and very hard to shake once it's there. Over the course of the book, I hope that you've been able to laugh at yourself for setting yourself impossible expectations and then berating yourself for not meeting them. Whilst we might be able to do anything, it's not fair to expect ourselves to do anything. Not only is it pointless, it's lonely. When you can do it all yourself, there's no excuse to bring other people along for the ride. And as we've learned, we need other people. If half is all you have to give, then that's great news. You have room to be joined by someone else who also has maths. also has halves. That's just maths. I'm obsessed with maths today. So another thing when I was writing this book was that I kept coming up against something that I tried not to write about, but it became sincerely impossible. And that is a game that I used to play when I was a child. Has anybody played the game, The Floor is Made of Lava? Yeah. So for those uninitiated, essentially the floor in your house is made of lava. And like, if you fall in the lava, you have to do a really huge pantomime death, like the grizzlier the better, froth at the mouth, roll your eyes to the back. It has to be like really dramatic. And the only way to not die from the lava is to make sure that you are elevated from the lava by sitting on your sofa or swinging from your parents' curtains. Or I never did that. My mum and dad are over there. Never did that. I just won by like hovering over the air. And like, you can do it on like dressers, antique tables, any of that. And it was an amazing game. And when I got older, I started coming up against this idea of the climate all the time. And it felt like this thing that was really out there and like, oh yeah, so I need to, get my degree and I need to try and save up for a mortgage and I need to do some good skincare and clean out my ears and occasionally go to the dentist. And then maybe I should save the environment because that's out there and that's apparently burning and that would be bad too, but I'll put it on the list. But as I started looking through all these different areas of our lives, I talk about careers, I talk about skin, I talk about body weight, I talk about lots of different stuff in the book. It all started to come back to the climate, and I realized that when we talk about the climate, we've become so desensitized to it that we don't realize how integrated it is into everything we talk about. And I wondered if instead we should talk about it like the floor, you know, because there's all these different dreams we have and we're encouraged to have these vision boards every January, like this is what my life to be like. We don't often think about how all of those dreams and all those things that we really, really want in our own futures have to happen on the floor unless you've got a hoverboard or you're able to like get a bit of landmass and unattach it from the rest of the planet and let it like float up into the sky. Without a floor, none of those dreams will be possible. So I talk a little bit about this idea of the floor is made of lava and how if we talked about it like in that way a little bit more, we could start to realize how urgent it is and how actually there can be some joy in trying to work that out. I think it's really exciting to sit down with like young graduates and be like, so, you know, your field, we have to literally reinvent everything in your field. And you can do that. You know, there's so to look for. We're not here for a lack of to-do lists in this world. And I think that's really, really exciting. I wanted to read a little bit from the end of the book because I think one of the questions that I get a lot is there any hope? Like, is this worth it? You know, what are we doing here? Like, how can we fix everything? And if I don't throw my whole ass in, like, how are we going to win? So I wrote a little bit about that in the end. And it is here. Sorry, one second. Yeah. A final reminder that the perfect is pointless. I'd like... Oh, sorry, no, I've already done that bit. I keep like going back and forward on what I want to read to you, because I read different things for different audiences. And I feel like with Greenbelt, so many of you are like already on board that I'm like, oh, I've got so many different things I want to say. So I wanted to talk a little about some of the half-ass hope strategies that I have started implementing it in my life. So the first one is a date with your MP. Steady. Not like that, please no. So depending on whether your own political persuasion matches with that of your MP, or your MP is particularly dishy, this might be more or less appealing to you. Of course, don't actually try and date your MP. A recent Guardian survey of the world's leading climate experts ranked voting for political candidates that advocate for strong climate action as one of the most effective things you can do as a citizen to help the planet right now. And that is more than reducing your meat consumption, flying less, improving your household insulation, or even having fewer children. Like, it is up there. So 75% of people in the UK don't know who their MP is. So we're already on the sign of, you know, does anybody know who their MP is? We're already winning, but like, you don't even, that's the half-assing done. Like, you already know, we're already winning. Of the people that do, can you imagine how many people write to them regularly? In the gaps between elections, reading their inbox is one of the only ways that members of parliament can gauge what is happening. And they actually have a tally in the office of being like, right, this is, I was talking to Jess Phillips about this. They have a tally of like how many people are emailing every week about certain topics. So I have tried to write to my MP regularly. I have like a little schedule in the diary, like we have a meeting. He doesn't know me, but I know him. So every week I try and write to my MP, or at least I have it in my diary. I probably do it about half or maybe a quarter of the times that it's in my diary. But I try and do that as much as possible. Even if your MP isn't politically aligned with you and they disagree with the substance of your request, they are still obliged to act on your behalf. And it's really good to remind them of that. And I think it makes a huge difference more than anything else we can do. Another thing is like I try and match the mission with the action. So sometimes there's a ropey connection between what we want to achieve and what the action we take that we think will get it done. We can get caught up in the inconvenience or seemingly unfeasible execution of that action and end up throwing our hands up in the air and being like, it's impossible, I can't do it. I fell into that trap some years ago when someone asked me why, if I was so worried about the planet, did I continue to buy makeup products that were packaged in plastic? And I was like, oh God, that's a really good point. So I started like spending loads of time like researching different mascara brands and being like, which one should I buy? And then somebody pointed out to me that they were like, Lena, how often do you buy mascara? And I was like, oh, once a year. And they were like, how often do you buy food? And I was like, every day I buy food. So they were like, maybe start there, maybe don't worry so much. We talk a lot about this kind of like looking at individual actions and being like, oh no, and you realize like how much time investment it can take to correct that certain action, and you think, actually maybe I need to ditch that and focus on something else entirely. So I have examples of idea that people should have one fewer child, which is very contested and something that I talk a little bit about online. I've done a very long video essay about how I don't think that's true when it comes to the climate. But something that you can do that is much more climate impactful and also very easy is moving your pension. You do it once and then you never have to worry about it for the rest of your life. So there's lots of stuff like that that I talk about in the book that I'm just like, I feel like if we started letting each other compare notes and do a little bit less, it can really go a long way. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the end, and then I'm going to take some questions on half-arsing. And this is your opportunity in the festival to say arse as many times as you like. So if you would like to just put your hand up and just say arse 20 times, and that's cathartic for you, I will take that as a question. We can go from there. That's fine. Whatever you need. If you feel spent, you're not the only one. Luckily, morsels of energy are still energy. Specks of hope are still hope. You never have nothing. I have never personally witnessed a completely empty peanut butter jar. Just saying, you're not trying hard enough. Even when someone declares it gone, there's always something to scrape and spread across your toast. Besides, how boring would it be to be a finished product? What hell it would to be whole. To half-ass is to human. To arse it up and dance anyway is divine. You and your arse have a long way to go. But the view from the side of the mountain is still pretty nice. I'll see you there and I'll bring my curly whirlies.
Thank you so much, Lena. I'm certainly feeling a lot better about my houseplant graveyard. I don't know about you. So we now come to some questions. I hope you've got some brewing. If you'd like to ask a question, just raise your hand and our wonderful roving mics team will come round and try and find you. And as I said before, if you've not asked a question at Greenbelt before or it's your first time, please do. This is a great opportunity to ask Lena that question. Fabulous. Hands up. Oh, Jo's already got one over here. Brilliant.
Thank you. Brilliant talk. I loved it. I was just wondering, as a self-proclaimed half-arser, how did you manage to finish your book?
Well, a funny thing about that is actually, so probably only people at the front will be able to see this, but I have these like pretty awful diagram. No offense, still buy the book, but like pretty, like very, very rough illustrations in the book. And there was no plan to have illustrations of the book, but I realised that pictures were the only way I was going to get across the visceral feeling of the arse. So I emailed my editor and I was like, I've done these rough sketches. Obviously, we'll have to get an illustrator or something to do them, but like, just don't laugh. But like, I've attached these sketches. And she was like, Lena, these are really terrible. And I was like, I know. She was like, it looks like you did them MS Paint. And I was like, I did do them in MS Paint. And she was like, we're putting them in. And I was like, no, we've got to do an illustrator. And she was like, you are supposed to be a half-arser and this is your first test. So I wasn't even allowed to correct some of the illustrations in this book. They are just in there, raw and wriggling for your consumption. So there were definitely lots of things like that where I was like, while I was writing it, I was like, actually, why does this have to be perfect? Like, why does this have to be the perfect listicle of everything? Actually, isn't it good if I make a list of all the different ways that you might be able to like reduce your carbon footprint and then somebody emails me with an extra one? It's like, brilliant. Then I get to have an interaction. I get to learn something. It doesn't have to be complete in that way. And I also think that when it comes to nonfiction writing, I think we can often get hung up on the craft of it. And I love the craft of it. I worked in book publishing for a long time and I love it and I care about it. But sometimes when it comes to just communicating an idea, like as long as I feel like the idea has been communicated, then it doesn't need to be the perfect word in the perfect format. So I got to like let go of a lot of that perfectionism as well. And also a deadline is incredibly inspiring. Don't know if you've ever been given a deadline, but oh, it really beats you. So yeah, but I think also like the thing with I do talk about whole arsing. There's a whole chapter called What to Whole Ass. You can imagine my inbox during writing this is just full of the word ass. It was overwhelming. Yeah, I talk about choosing things to whole ass. And one of my theories is that I'm like, I think it's really good if you throw yourself completely into everything at the exclusion of almost everything else, if it's for a really short period of time and you let everybody else know in your life and you almost like bring people on board and recruit people. So I was being like, trying to write this book. Here's the mission statement. I think it's going to be brilliant or at least a little bit silly. I'm not going to be able to see you for another few months, but like, if you could send me a postcard, that would be great. Or like, you know what I mean? Like, can we meet up and can I write next to you while you knit? Or like, can we do, you know, I started to try and like adapt my life so I would be able to whole ass this and like recruit people to the short term mission. But had I lived in this state for like years and years and years, then I might have gone a little bit doolally. So I think it's that thing of like, if you can set yourself a time period to really commit, then I think it's amazing. But I think the way the rhetoric of like modern life goes is that you should always be in that mode and there's no room for sabbaticals and holidays and time off and moments of not thinking about it. So I think it's as much to do with volume and like tweaking the dials of your life as it is to do with like commitment versus being lazy. No commitment. It's kind of about that as well. But yes, I invite you to read it and find all the errors in it, because there probably are some. But yes.
We've got a question down here, is that right?
You're like, no, I don't have a question.
No, don't want a question.
You can just say arse into the mic a lot if you want. You just have a really good opportunity.
There's a couple over here.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to ask about imposter syndrome, which makes you want to whole ass everything and then beat yourself up because, you know, you whole assed it and it's still terrible. I'm just me, okay. How would you deal with that and half-assing things? Because I love the idea of it, but I don't think the brain gremlins will allow it just yet.
That's fair. I think with imposter syndrome, it's really interesting because I talk a little bit in the book about, instead of seeing it as imposter syndrome, I often was given jobs that I was like, oh, why did they give me this job? This is like, why has somebody let me wear like the big hat or have access to this inbox, or why they let me do this? And I started treating it more like I was kind of a spy. So I was like, people don't know I'm not qualified for this job. How long can I get away with being in this job and nobody notice? What would somebody do who was pretending to be a qualified version of me? And how would they do it? And I started like making little files in my inbox of like, oh, this is for my spy folder, for like, so I can research what I'm actually supposed to be doing in my job. And also it became like a kind of undercover project of me, like, but it also made me realize, like, as I more embodied the spy ethos, I started actually embodying my character and becoming a bit qualified because I was doing all the research to try and cover my tracks for not being qualified. But I also started to realize how much I respected the people who had hired me or invited me into that room or asked for my opinion. And if I started to doubt my own value or qualifications, I was also by default devaluing theirs, like that they can't tell who's good in an interview setting. They can't tell that I can do something, or they haven't watched me do something and let me keep doing it without stopping me. So I think it's also about like when we devalue our own contribution, how we're devaluing the people who have asked us for help or invited us into those conversations, and being like, well, if I'm not an expert, then they're not an expert because they've screwed up by getting me in here. So either they're also awful, and we're both awful together, and then that's fine because now we're all a company of awful people. Or, you know, actually they do know what they're talking about. They've asked me here for a reason, and therefore, like, I'm definitely not an imposter. Hopefully.
I was just wondering, how do you boundary your half-arsedness? Is that a word? When everybody around you wants you to be whole acidness.
So I actually have some, because another thing, a bugbear of mine is like self-help books that don't actually give you much help and they don't give you practical. So I actually have like written out phrases for different scenarios to be like, I can't do that right now because I'm doing this. But a lot of the thing, like I said, with the book, like getting people on board, I've often found that helpful in situations where I'm doing something else that isn't what they'd like me to be doing. But talking and being like, this is my passion, like this is what I'm so excited about, I need to leave early to go and do it. Or actually, can you help me out with this? Because you know how I'm trying to do that project that I really love and you're now invested in emotionally because I word spewed at you at it for so long and I've shown you pictures of me doing it. And so I think like getting people on board in that way, but also using a little bit of like research. So I'm always like questioning, like, you know, is staying longer in your job actually effective? No, the science says there was a big no. No. And one of the examples I give in the book is like, I talk about this idea of morning routines and how like if you get up early and you do these things and you have like an ice bath and then you have a matcha latte and then you do your morning pages and then you do a little bit of yoga and then you put your toes above your head, how like all of these promises. And I listed some of the promises in these common morning routines of like what it will do for you if you get up at 5 a.m. and you do this stuff. So it's like boost your immune system, regulate your blood sugar levels, balance your hormones, improve your memory recall, process your emotions, uplift your mental well-being, de-escalate your anxiety, cleanse the toxic proteins that can cause Alzheimer's, like all of that list. And then I checked it against the list of things you get if you just sleep for more hours. And it's the same list. It's the same list. You need between 7 to 9 hours a night for all of those good things, and getting up at 5 a.m. cancels that out. So by my maths, my girl maths, we're even. So there's lots of things like that where you're like, hang on a second. And then I also looked at all the people that were kind of hailed in this research of like getting up early and being a girl boss. And like they're people like Benjamin Franklin, Henry David Thoreau, Ronald Reagan, Winston Churchill, and Margaret Thatcher. And I don't think that all of those people did a very good job. Just some feedback. Margaret Thatcher slept for 4 hours a night, and I think it showed. I don't know what your specific situation is, but like I think that maybe like going back and being like, do we know for sure that me doing this thing will help me or anyone? And then bring your little notebook and be like, actually, I think you'll find on Wikipedia page 659. But yeah, that would be my bring your receipts. But yes,
we've got a question here.
Hi. So obviously you've written an amazing book about how to be a half-ass human, but in your like everyday life, how do you explain to people who are judging you or want to judge you or don't understand why you're not doing things that they think that you should do? So, you know, for example, I've just left sixth form. So, you know, and there are lots of people who think that you should put more effort into things like school or work instead of, for example, activism or, you know, other things like that, or your hobbies, passions. How do you explain to people in your everyday life simply how to be, why you're doing what you're doing?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it is this emphasis on talking about what you're walking towards rather than what you're walking away from, and like making it clear that you do have a plan. But I think like there are great analogies. Like my one is like the floor is made of lava. And just like, I would really love to do this thing, but actually I'm just going to like spend the next 5 years making sure the floor's okay so that then I can do that thing. You know what I mean? Like I'm going to get an amazing career in 5 years once I've made sure that there's a really good floor to have a career on and stuff like that. But I think, yeah, having a little spiel in your head that talks about why you want to whole ass the thing you want to whole ass is really good, because I think sometimes in those moments you feel quite defensive and just like, oh no, they don't understand, they'll never understand me, and you start coming up with all the negative reasons you shouldn't be, you don't want to do those things that they think should be on your to-do list. So I think more like making sure that 75% of the conversation is about like what you actually want to do and why, and then making the other things like, because I think sometimes there are loads of things that like, yes, it sounds really good to do all these smaller things in your life to improve your life, but they ultimately, when you add them all up, they take away from the big reason in your life. And knowing that you can only really give 100%, and I recommend only giving 50%. doing that maths with people and being like, this doesn't add up, because if I do this every week, or if I do this, if I spend 8 hours of my day doing this, then I only get 1 hour for this, and it needs more than 1 hour to be completed. Therefore, you know what I mean? So kind of doing that, like talking in fractions more than talking in like, oh, I don't want to do that because it's rubbish. You know? So I think instead of like having an argument, being like, well, how would you solve this maths problem? You know, if I want to complete this, how do I do that? And yeah, especially when it comes to activism and stuff, I think it's really cool to just to be like, This from what I can see from the whole world in the context of everything, this is the most important thing right now. And if it becomes less important in 5 years, great, I'll pivot. You know, I think it's that thing of pivoting as well and being like, I'm willing to be wrong later. I hope that I'm wrong. But yeah, I hope that helps.
Yeah. Do you think have you found that there's a big overlap in half-assing and the neurodivergent sort of population?
I knew he'd come to me for advice one day. Sorry, so can you start again? I was really confused where your voice is coming from, and for some reason I really needed to know.
Have you found or do you think there's like a big overlap in half-assing and sort of neurodivergency and sort of the population with that?
Yeah, so I have had a lot of people who are neurodivergent read it and say that it's helped them. I'm not myself, but I hear it, and there's a lot of things that I definitely identify with it. But I think, again, it's that overarching expectation that I think sometimes we focus so much on conversations like some people are negative about neurodivergence and their and people's needs is that they focus so much on that when they don't focus so much on how this the way we've set the world up doesn't work for like most people's brains. Like even the neurotypical people don't seem to be doing well. So I think again, like looking at that system and being like, is anybody having fun? And like, could this be more flexible? And wouldn't everybody benefit from being able to customize their workflow and explain how their brains work a little bit better and trying to feel that out together? And I think neurodivergence is such a huge umbrella, and even like very specific diagnosis within it. I've got a feeling that I'm like, in 20 years, I think there'll be like 10 different words for that, and people will have 10 different experiences within each diagnosis that we don't yet understand. So I think like explaining it to people in a way that's just like, if we free up our to-do lists and our systems and make them more customizable for everybody, and believe people when they say they want to customize them and not give them like a huge interview about why they need to do it, I think it would work better for everybody. And again, it's this thing of being like, if I can only turn up half the time, could you do the other half? And do you think that would work? There's an example in the book of two colleagues that I used to work with when I worked in a publishing house. And they used to be two publicists who had two separate jobs, and they became friends, and they were on the same team, and they both wanted to have a baby, not together. They want to have separate babies. And so they decided that they were both going to try for babies, and whoever had the baby first would go on maternity leave. And then the other one would start doing their job. And when they both came back after maternity leave, they pitched to the company together that they were like, we are one person. We are so effective, and we're so effective that we can probably both do our job in 3 days. So what we're pitching to you is we both work 3 days a week, and we have one email address, and on Wednesdays we both work and we do one person's job, but we do it really, really well. So you should probably pay us like twice as much. And the company were like, yeah, actually, that's great. So they both have one job and they have one email address, and they're kind of interchangeable. So I'd like call up one and be like, hey, Mary, this thing. And then if I talked to the other one about it a week later, they'd know exactly what I was talking about because they'd been so communicative with each other. They kind of acted like one person. But it meant that all the jobs kept being done all the time, and all the bases kept being covered, but they were only doing like half of the job, in inverted commas. And it's actually meant that they've actually started interviewing for jobs together. So when they wanted to move roles, they just applied as one person and turned up to the interview, and they were like, here's the deal. There's two of us. We work. Here's our portfolio. We work really well together, but we're both only going to work 3 days a week, but you're going to get an amazing deal. And they've gone with it. And they're literally, they're just like moving around the world as one working force. But only doing half, and it's incredible to watch. And also they cover so many more bases because within themselves, they're having their own debates about what to do that's best for the job. And one of them will have heard a rumor about something and tell the other one, or they you know, watch something on TV and be like, we can use that idea, let's do this. So they actually have more tentacles and they're being more effective, but they're also getting their customized life that they want to live and getting to do the other things that are much more important to them, which is their children. So it's like, there's so much stuff like that that I think if workplaces could be more understanding of that, and we could have like a job pal, it would mean that we felt more comfortable in our jobs, and it is less about like personal recognition. Like one of them could never win an award without the other one. Like nobody's walking home with like publicist of the year award without the other one. But the trade-off for that is that you mean that you've always got your covers, and it's less lonely in that way as well. I think you can't be an imposter in your job if you'd be insulting your work partner. So I think it's again, yeah, about assessing ourselves together rather than apart. But yes, I think I went really off topic with your neurodivergent question, but I hope that helped. God. God is neurodivergent.
Fabulous. I think we've got a question down here.
Hi there. I'm the parent of a three-year-old. I'm over here.
Thank you.
Three-year-old daughter. And I think we know that, the younger generation is growing up with a lot of anxiety thanks to social media and the state of the world. Do you have any advice about how we can raise the next generation of half-arses to be brilliant half-arses?
Yes, play them my audiobook as they go to sleep. Subconsciously goes into their brains. I don't know. I'm not a parent myself, but I imagine this idea of like not having perfection as a goal. And like when you see somebody who's perfect, being like, I wonder what they gave up to do that. Or like, what don't they get to do because they are an Olympic world athlete? And they've made that trade-off and that's cool, but they must be missing out on all these things. I wonder why. I wonder if it's worth it, you know? So I imagine there's stuff like that that would help. And also just like in general, like I think there's a weird thing where you like, and I've done it a lot, when I meet a child, I like panic and I go, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because it just feels like a nice, interesting thing to ask a child. But it's kind of not useful to be like, this is your leading from a young age. Like you're part of like, oh, my favorite color is this. This is the age that I am. And I want to be a fireman when I grow up or something. And it's one, like if you don't get that, who are you? And also it's just this thing of like your career becomes part of who you are at such a young age. And I think I've heard people talk a lot about, you know, at parties, it's like, oh yeah, hi, I'm Lena. What do you do? Oh, this is what I do. And it's the first question. But it also seems to be the first question we ask children. And that's like weird because my job is being a YouTuber. That's bizarre. But there's actually more people in the UK now that are full-time YouTubers than there are working in UK book publishing. Like there's more people. So it's like this weird thing that never existed when I was a child. And I wonder if this is just kind of being like, you don't know what the world's going to be like when you're older. And that's kind of cool. Like we don't know what's going to happen for you and what's going to interest you in the future because it probably hasn't been invented yet. And just, yeah, I think that's parenting advice. Don't know if I should give that, but I definitely think that that would have helped me and lots of other people.
Hello. I guess I wanted to ask the, like, whole arsing thing. Mm. I have great ideas for what I want to whole arse. And like you talked about the exercising thing of you should only really be upping it by like 10% a week or whatever. Mm. And you try to set reasonable goals, but they're so boring. Do you have any advice about how to whole arse in a less boring way that's actually reasonable for what you can do?
Yeah,
I guess is the question.
I'm really big on bingo cards because you can't lose a bingo card as long as you get three in a row. Do you know what I mean? So I usually start the year with like 9 goals in a grid, but like they're not goal. Like if I don't do all 9, that's fine because I'm just trying to get bingo. You know what I mean? So as long as I get 3 in a row somewhere, that tickles my brain for some reason. And I think also just making sure that you know where, like, cause I talk a little bit more after the section on desire paths about direction and being like, you can pick a direction for where you're going, but you don't need to pick a pace right now. And you can just be like, that's the stretch goal. I often try and make a goal and half it because we're often always like overambitious about our future selves and very self-deprecating about our current self. So I think making sure that everything you want to do, you only promise yourself that you'll do half. And then if you get more, that's great. But, you know, you haven't. I think there's a lot to be said for proving yourself right. And like if you set your goals a little bit lower and you meet them, you get a bit of self-accreditation with yourself. You're like, oh look, I'm somebody who sets goals and does them, rather than somebody who makes really bad, because then you just become a bad goal planner rather than a bad person. You're just like, I didn't fail at that, I was just really bad at I was a bad goal setter that day and I set myself a silly goal. So yeah, building credit with yourself and being like, I can do the small things, is great. But yeah, I would recommend a bingo, even if in the bingo card is like all one thing, like all one theme, but like there's different tasks within it or different things. But again, in the body section, I talk about how like your body doesn't really care how often you exercise as long as you do, I think it's 150 minutes a week. There's no research to suggest that daily is any better than weekly. And like, you know, it's just, and if you do, you know, two days off, 2 days on, like your body doesn't really care that much. And it also doesn't lose muscle mass that fast. So you can also take 2 weeks off and you don't lose your muscle if you're going for muscles. But you know what I mean? Like your body is much more forgiving than you think it is. And it doesn't care as much. There's not that, like, I think be wary of somebody who's trying to sell you a formula of how to get healthy, because like there's not that many. You know, the more specific it is, the more suspect it is. So yeah, but big fan of the bingo cards.
Brilliant. We've got time for one last question over here, I think.
Hi, I have emailed my MP and I wasn't happy with the result I got.
Join the club.
Do you have any tips for how to write a good email to your MP in a way that just makes it easy and not crushing when you get a form response?
Well, actually, I can recommend somebody else's book. So my friend Sarah Corbett is around the way, is around lots. She's doing like 11 events or something. She is around. But she has a great book called How to Be a Craftivist. And she talks a little bit about emotionally connecting with people in power. And like, she did like an amazing project with people where she sewed them handkerchiefs with like what they'd like their MP to do and like sign them to their MP and stuff, and doing like small actions that show how meaningful it would be if they helped you. But yeah, her whole book on like slow, quiet activism and like treating people in power as people and working out what they actually need to get that support or what they might be afraid of and trying to like work with that. And she's done some incredible stuff with M&S and like the living wage and stuff. So yeah, I appeal to more knowledgeable people than me on that topic, because I also get some very dissatisfactory emails back from my MP, and yet I continue to send them. I think also there is like a kind of glory in just being annoying. You know what I mean? Like, I know that this is annoying and I'm going to keep annoying you because that's my job. And your job is to inspire me to be less annoying. So I think, again, like they do tally up what those email themes are about, and I think making that really clear. But I also talk in the vegan chapter, I talk a bit about how I think it'd be better if there were more really bad chatty vegans in the world that are like rubbish at doing it, miss the mark all the time, have a Nutella sandwich once a week, but talk about it all the time and like loosen people up about being like, I do this and I think it's helping because of these reasons and I struggle with these reasons. But, and so I think it's better to not only write to your MP, but mention that you do it, not in a, you know, not in an arsey way, in a half arsey way. And just, yeah, like, I think we'll get somewhere more like faster if we're all doing it, and then it's harder for him to send. I'm saying him, I don't know who, I'm just scared. It's harder for them to send you a bad email if they have to send it to like 200 people and then they get 200 complaints back. So yeah, banding together I think is good.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Lena. That was fabulous. Please give a big round of applause to Lena for a wonderful talk.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.